3:32, and our next guest on Downtown is responsible for some of the best music journalism in recent years, the author of books like Bruce, Paul McCartney, A Life, and Catch a Wave, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of Brian Wilson. His newest is entitled Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. We're pleased to be joined on the phone this afternoon by author Peter Ames Carlin. Peter, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I love the book so much as a Paul Simon fan, as a music fan, but it was such an interesting read. Is it safe to say from your research that Paul Simon is a guy who for his whole life has been driven by his insecurities?
Oh, my gosh, sure. I mean, who isn't, really? but on the other hand, I think he's also got, that's sort of the thing that sort of like, it's like the fuel rods, I think, for a lot of creative people. They're trying to fill a hole of one sort or the other. And so for Paul, that was just his impetus to keep going and creating and building and doing more and more and bigger and better things for so many decades. And, you know, I think it can make your art, you know, that much more vital. But on the other hand, I think it's also not a particularly comfortable place to be.
He was very self-conscious about his appearance as a young man and throughout his entire life. I was struck by the relationship with his father. From the outside, a very loving, supportive family. His dad, a musician, and one would think that would lend to support for a career in music. But his dad never thought being a musician was the honorable thing to do, had a career change of his own. And it took him a while to accept what his son was doing.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting dynamic. You know, on the one hand, I think it's so clear that Paul's father, Louis Simon, who as a musician worked under the name Lee Sims, was adored, both of his sons, I mean, Paul and his younger brother, Eddie, and was a wonderful father to them in a lot of ways. But I think that Paul's getting into so deeply into the business that he had been in for so many years, because Lou was also a professional musician, a bass player, who had his own dance band, along with playing a lot of sessions. And fairly instantly seeing Paul, I think, eclipse him in so many different ways, in virtually every way in music, had to have been a difficult thing for him. And I think he also believed very deeply in the honor and the purpose of being a teacher, which is what he made into a second career for himself.
The relationship with Art Garfunkel, in many ways, the most significant, certainly, of his professional life, and that was fascinating for me to read how that started with Paul Simon watching Art Garfunkel perform from afar. And was it about 2 years after he watched him sing in school for the first time before he reached out and tried to start a friendship?
Yeah, you know, he kept his eye on Artie sort of from afar. As school kids, little elementary school kids, they had both been drawn into an assembly, an all-school assembly, when the school buses to take them home at the end of the day was late. And to kill time, they were having people come on stage and tell jokes or whatever. They invited Artie to come up and sing a song because he loved to do that in his classroom. And as Paul noticed from out in the cafeteria seats, the moment Artie opened his mouth and that beautiful sound of his, young voice came out, the entire place, I mean, you could hear a pin drop. And I think Paul also noticed that girls and sitting around him were absolutely transfixed. And he noted, not only the beauty of his voice, but also the intensity of the response that he was getting. And as Paul said later, he realized instantly, I want me some of that.
And that relationship off and on for five decades plus, and one of those where almost like brothers, they supported each other at times, but they were both uniquely qualified to push the buttons that would aggravate the other guy.
Yeah. You know, people say, there's that old line, somebody says, your family, it's so easy for your family to push your buttons because they're the ones who installed them, And I think that's definitely true with Paul and Artie. I think that they've been so close for so long, especially going back to early adolescence, that, they know the exact geography of one another's strong points and weak points, and they know how to shore each other up, and they know how to rip each other down. And for whatever reason, there's a kind of a competition between them that's so intense that at times it makes it impossible for them to be around one another.
We're talking with Peter Ames Carlin, author of Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. Peter, in reading the book, I felt at times like the community that both Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel grew up in was almost another character in their story.
Sure. You know, you mean Kew Gardens Hills, where they grew up in Queens, or just throughout their lives, their artistic community?
No, I think that background in Queens and what was happening in the country and the upward mobility of people and in many ways the second generation, third generation immigrant experience.
Exactly. The immigrant thing, I think, is very important in understanding Paul Simon's life and his career. His grandparents were Jewish immigrants from Central Europe, or Eastern Europe, and they got to America in the late 19th and early 20th century. And so much about the Simon family story, starting in that sort of old world orthodoxy, just coming through Ellis Island in the early 20th century, all the way through the point where Paul has done about everything he possibly can to sort of not be seen as a particularly Jewish artist in one way or the other. But that's a process, that process from orthodoxy to assimilation that so many immigrant families live. And when I look at Paul's music over the years and the way that he's journeyed from doo-wop to pop in the 50s and then to folk music and sort of neo-psychedelic pop music in the 60s and up through his gospel and rhythm and blues type stuff and all the way up through, you know, the South African music and the Brazilian and South American percussion stuff that he did later. It's all just one assimilation after another. And for the vast majority of his career, he's made it look effortless and made it sound beautiful, you know, despite there being hurt feelings and accusations along the way, some of which are richly deserved, others maybe less so.
For a guy who changed his own identity, both his name when he was Jerry Landis starting out and various nom de plumes along the way, and changed his musical styles many times, one would think that maybe he would see a brother in Bob Dylan, but there was quite a rivalry there. What fueled that rivalry?
Because they're sort of the same type of person and the same type of artist in a lot of ways. I mean, I think it was hurtful for Paul, especially early on, when because Dylan's first record or two were the ones that really, I think, pushed him over the edge in terms of moving his career from kind of pop music to folk music and then to that particular kind of modern folk that Dylan was writing, you know, adapting older themes and songs and ideas to the modern age and making them very vital and of the moment. Paul had the same kind of poetic ambitions, the same kind of musical ambitions, and when he was constantly sort of compared to Dylan in the early years, it was always to Paul's, more to Dylan's benefit than to Paul's. The one thing I noticed, I think Paul has sort of let that drop in more recent decades. They seem far more friendly than before, but it was interesting to notice that when Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature a few weeks ago, the announcement was made on Paul's 75th birthday on October 13th.
As a person, it seems throughout the book that he's a tough guy to read. He could be cold and calculating and selfish, and then other times incredibly generous, and there didn't seem to be a real pattern there that I could detect.
I think that it's easier for him to be kind to people who he doesn't feel particularly in competition with. There are a lot of artists sort of through the years who can point to Paul as being a key part of what got them started in showbiz or what built them the kind of career. You know, I mean, the singing group The Roaches, the women who have been so popular in the late 70s through the 80s and into the 90s and continue to be, that they, you know, Paul, the two older sisters, Maggie and Terry, snuck into a songwriting class he was giving at NYU in 1970 when they were both, they were still both in high school. And Paul heard them sing a couple songs and loved what he heard, so he said, okay, you're in the class. And a few years after that, they came to him, you know, having grown up a bit and really wanting to up their game. And he heard what they were playing then, took him under his wing, and it was really, you know, and helped produce their first record. And it was really only about 3 or 4 years later that they really burst onto the scene and started having, you know, national-sized hits. And Chris Botti, the jazz trumpeter, more recently, started out as just like a young replacement trumpet player in Paul's 1991 tour. And Paul, sort of having gotten to know him and to hear him play and get a sense of his ambitions, signed him to like an incredibly luxe publishing contract, which essentially gave him $250,000 to put his band together, get his act together, and take it on the road and become the very successful jazz musician that Chris Botti is today.
The Graceland album is probably the most acclaimed of his career, but also one that got the most criticism. Did that whole process sort of cover both the best and the worst of Paul Simon's nature?
In a lot of ways, it did. I mean, I think the worst parts of it were more in control. I think that the good in that record and in his behavior around how he made that record far outweighs the bad stuff. I mean, primarily there are two sort of beefs with Paul about Graceland. The first is political, because, of course, that was at the end of the apartheid era when people were fighting desperately to restore a native government to South Africa rather than the racist apartheid party that were running the government in the mid-80s. And there was a cultural boycott designed to keep artists and organizations from the rest of the world to go into South Africa and basically treat them like a normal country when they weren't anything like that. The boycott did not cover recording in South Africa. It was a gray area. So Paul took advantage of that and went in. The second and I think probably more interesting issue is the idea of cultural imperialism. Is it okay for a white New Yorker to go to South Africa and record with South African musicians and then come home saying, this music is mine, this is a Paul Simon record with these people playing on it? Is he stealing their culture? But the interesting thing is, the South African music, the pop music in South Africa, is distinctly theirs in so many ways. A lot of it comes from the Zulu tradition and from other sort of tribal chant and music traditions, but the way that this form of pop music got started goes back to a fellow named Solomon Linda in the early 20s who combined a Zulu chant with the ragtime and rhythm and blues and jazz records that were coming into South Africa from the United States back in the early part of the 20th century. And so the reason that the South African pop sounded so instantly familiar to Paul was that it came down through the same roots that African American music had come through as well.
You write in the book, Peter, about his successes along the way, but also about his failures. And with Paul Simon, even the failures have been larger than life. Whether it's the Cape Man or One Trick Pony, nothing happens in a small way in his story.
Absolutely not. I mean, and that to me was one of the most fascinating things as I started to work on the book. Was just, you know, in the course of a nearly 60-year career, Paul has been associated, you know, most often directly with everything from the civil rights movement of the late 50s and early 60s to the start. You know, he was a founding member of the board for the Monterey Pop Festival, which was kind of the launch of the hippie era in the U.S., or at least the popular conception of it. He was involved with the launch of Saturday Night Live in the mid-70s, being such a close friend of Lorne Michaels, the original producer of the show. He co-starred in Woody Allen's movie Annie Hall, which most people feel is still the best movie he ever made. And it goes all the way up into the apartheid conflict, and then on to kind of the rebirth of the musical on Broadway and beyond. I mean, he's just it's phenomenal to see exactly how far his reach has extended for so many years of American history.
The book concludes with an interesting encounter, not exactly a meeting of the minds, but you did have a bit of an encounter with him. Can you tell the story of how that came to pass?
Yeah, well, you know, he was giving a series of lectures at Emory University in the fall of 2013, and I got and I had talked to the fellow who was running the lectures, and it was it's a big deal at Emory. They bring in only the most high-flying literary figures, you know, Seamus Heaney and Salman Rushdie, those types of people. And so they invited Paul as like the first, you know, musician poet to come and speak to them. And so I went to see the lectures, and I went to one lecture a little early and just happened to find a place in the pews of this church where it was taking place. And I was just getting my stuff together, my little pens and notebooks and things. And I looked up. The place was still nearly empty, but Paul was somehow already sitting on his chair on stage. And I was sitting by myself in the middle of this area. And suddenly I realized that he was staring at me and kind of staring me down in that way where somebody looks at you just with this long, unblinking gaze. And so I just kind of looked back at him, and finally, you know, he knew I was working on this book. He knew I was at Emory. He was kind of keeping me sort of pinned to my place, I think. And then he held up his hand in that kind of universal police halt sign, and then looked away very, you know, and, so I thought about that for a really long time, and it seemed relevant to me. So I thought it was funny, too, so I popped it into the back of the book.
Paul Simon seems to be constantly through his whole life driven by restlessness. When you look back at his amazing catalog of music, would you look at a song maybe like Something So Right as the song that perhaps gets closest to the core of what Paul Simon's about?
You know, that's a very interesting song because it's such a loving, you know, it's like, I think it was like, it's one of his sweetest love songs, and it's this statement of contentment and of unalloyed happiness that goes along with, you know, romantic love. But of course, you know, you listen to the chorus, it's very sort of self-deprecating and funny, but, you know, the line that keeps repeating is, you know, when something goes wrong, you know, I'm the last to know it, I'm the first one to know, or, you know, whatever, the last one to know. But with Something So Right, it just confuses me. You know, I don't even know what to think when something feels this good to me. And I thought that was kind of a funny but also sort of bittersweet revelation to put into his song.
And he released his most recent album earlier this year. It got tremendous reviews, one of his highest performing albums in some time. And then he talked about maybe this being the last one. Is he, from your perspective, is he at peace, and can he ever be at peace?
Well, you know, I mean, there's different kinds of being at peace. I mean, I think that, he's had this loving relationship with and long marriage to Edie Brickell. They have three grown children who are all seem like very interesting and lovely people. He's got his older son that he had with his first wife in the early 70s, also a very interesting person, a musician, and by all accounts a lovely person. But on the other hand, you know, I mean, I still think there's that burning, you know, music is kind of not what he does. It's more like who he is. And I think that quest, you know, that sense of constantly wanting to make more music, you know, not because I think it's less of a choice than just a reality and who, you know, is how he lives. The other interesting thing to note is that Paul has been talking about retiring from showbiz since 1958.
Right.
When he told a reporter from his high school newspaper that the pop thing was, he and Artie were going to quit doing pop music, even though they'd had one early hit on the charts. By the time they went to college in the fall of 58, that would all be over. They were going to pursue the normal lives they'd been raised to pursue. And he said the same thing in 1966 when the first few hits came, and he told a newspaper in England that he was going to be a novelist. That was really his calling. Music was going to be over in a few months. You know, he just says it over and over and over again, and so he said it again, maybe for the 10th time, to this fellow from the New York Times this fall, and somehow it was a big story all over again, he very relatively quickly said he actually had no intention of retiring at this point.
Well, the research is outstanding, amazing on this. It's a fascinating look at one of the most interesting guys in music history and at the creative process as well. Peter Ames Carlin, the book is called Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's 3:51 here on Downtown. We'll take a little break. Much more to come on the program this afternoon. You're listening to The Pulse, AM 620 WZON.
Do we ever agree on anything?
We both like the Bangor Mall Cinema 10.
The cozy stadium seating.
I like the bargain prices for all shows on Tuesday.
Hot buttered popcorn and candy.
The Dolby and digital surround sound is perfect.